You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
Good. It'll be fun to chat.
I'm looking forward to it. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast, available on our YouTube channel, Non-Zero YouTube channel, and our podcast feed. You are Nathan Lambert. You're an AI guy. For starters, you build open source large language models at the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence, which is also known as AI2, I assume, because the initials of Allen Institute and artificial intelligence are both AI. Did I get that one right?
Yeah, that's all right.
Okay. And it is funded by the estate of the late Paul Allen, who was a co-founder of Microsoft. And I think they do a lot of stuff other than AI maybe as well. Is there a larger Allen Institute that's...
There's multiple Allen Institutes. So the first one was actually the Allen Institute, which we call the Allen Institute for Biology, or we call it AI1. And then the Allen Institute for AI came after.
The
Paul Allen umbrella in Seattle runs wide. So there are a lot of other things, but I don't know of any other by the Allen Institute name.
Okay. And you are in Seattle, where so many Microsoft-related things are. Before we get into open source, which I think is a really important subject, probably for a lot of people, it first entered their attention via the publicity DeepSeek got about 8 months ago. It got publicity both because it was a Chinese model that was very impressive, and because it was an open source model, it was very impressive. In fact, I guess, could you say that at the time it was both the most powerful Chinese model and the most powerful open source model in the world? Or would that be going too far?
Yeah, I would. I think there's some, we'll get into the technicalities on the like open source word and open weight, but we don't,
right.
I won't begrudge the audience diving into that from the beginning. But yeah, that's what made DeepSeek so impactful, is that it was this all the things at once, which is just this... China really entering the AI race in a loud way. And then the fact that open models were now just about as good as what OpenAI had just released a few months earlier. So that was kind of such a wild time. And we could do a retrospective, which would be fun in a way. It's like 8 months later of DeepSeek.
I do want to get back into that. And I do want to, before we get into open source, more deeply do what you suggested and clarify its meaning. But first, I'm going to actually ask you a question I've asked almost no guests. Do you have a PDUM?
I mean, if you make me give a number, I'll give something that's less than 1%. I'll say like, DOOM is also debatable. I would say it's like probability that AI makes it so we're back in the Stone Ages, I would say of like 0.1% or some very low thing. I think that I talk about a lot of things with AI, and I don't talk about that because the risks that I think about are like concentration of power or social media plus. It's like if Facebook has 10 times better AI, like what does the Reels app do? And so on. That's the thing that motivates me. And I just want more people to be able to understand these really powerful models, which is then downstream is the openness thing for me.
Yeah, I would have guessed a low PDUM because you're obviously an open source advocate. In fact, you think America should have a more robust open source ecosystem, and that open source should be more robustly funded. There are people who worry about OpenAI, even people who think it shouldn't be legal. They tend to have a high PDUM, or higher than yours anyway. We'll get into the logic of that. And it is also very relevant to the question of the concentration of power and some other things. But maybe we should start by clarifying the meaning. Let me just give my understanding, my like layperson's understanding, and then you can correct me and tell me everything was wrong or tell me I got it. I get an A, but you want to add something. So first of all, there are people who say the term is misleading. We should usually when people talk about open source, they're really talking about open weights models. Weights. Oh, I forgot to plug your newsletter, by the way. Interconnections newsletter.
Interconnects with an S at the end.
Oh, Interconnects. Interconnects newsletter for Substack. The reason that came to mind is because I was about to start talking about the connections among the neurons in large language. Is that what inspired the title?
The interconnects are like the essentially the networking cables in GPUs. Mm-hmm. So when you buy GPUs, you need to buy these.
I see.
You need to have the high quality interconnects if you want to train a good model and train it fast, which is like something that NVIDIA historically dominated. So it's like it's a play on the information moving layer of training models.
Okay. So that is a physical interconnection, whereas the kind we're talking about when we're talking about weights are not physical in the same sense, right? Because the neurons are not these physical things in the same sense that a chip is a thing.
So it's a big matrix of numbers.
it's in software form, but you can imagine it as a physical thing. Anyway, so a large language model has a ton of these things called neurons. The average neuron is connected to a lot of other neurons, not all of the ones in the model, but a lot. All told, there are like billions, hundreds of billions, sometimes even trillions of connections among neurons in a model. And after the training is finished, and by training, I mean to include what's called pre-training, post-training, everything, and the model is like ready to go, what then each of those connections, jillions, has been assigned a number that's referred to as the weight of that connection, right? And what a weight, we can think of a weight, loosely speaking, as, stop me if I get anything seriously wrong.
I think I can help you. So it's a neuron in like linking to biology has kind of multiple meanings. The weight is essentially a number. And the architecture of the model, this thing that people talk about, is like an order of operations where you're using different weights at different steps. And the weights are essentially all the numbers you need to do this really complicated function. So you take them piece by piece and you have like a layer, which is a collection of weights that manipulates a number. And then the complex function you have is the next layer is just told where to point in software and to like where to get the previous number from. And those would be like, that would be like the interconnection in your analogy between neurons, which is just software, which is saying like, where does the next layer get its number from in this kind of really complex transformation?
Okay. And at this point, we should maybe add then, since you've used the word layer, that there are layers of neurons and the information flows. You can think of it as top to bottom or bottom to top. But anyway, it goes sequentially. And I mean, to get back to the neuron metaphor, which I think, and it's in a way, it's not just a metaphor, right? I mean, you could build a physical thing and have the, you know, stuff actually moving, but it's just not done that way. Anyway, a neuron in a given layer is connected to every other neuron in the layer above it and the layer below it, right? And not to other neurons that are in further away from it in layers, right?
It depends on the type of model, but for people that don't know like what is in a language model, it's like the simplest way to think about it, which is you have these numbers that communicate with the number other numbers around them, and then there's more nuance we could add to that.
Or the layperson's way of thinking would be the neurons are communicating with other neurons, right?
Yeah, that's the original
motivation.
They're
getting numbers from, so a neuron, if you think of the information moving from top to bottom. A neuron is getting numbers from the neurons in the layer above it. And to get back to the weights are assigned to each connection through which it's getting, each unique connection through which it's getting one of these numbers has a weight. And that tells the neuron, in a sense, how much importance to attach to the number it's getting, or, you know, kind of what to multiply it by, how big a number to multiply it by, in a certain sense, before passing it on, right?
Yeah.
So. But the main thing is that after the training's all over, like, and OpenAI has put a shitload of money into training it, the weights are what they paid for, mainly. I mean, there's some other stuff, but the weights, all of these billions of weights, are what constitute the model to a large extent. Understandably, a private company like OpenAI is not enthusiastic about having spent all this money to get these weights telling its competitors what the weights are. So
yeah, you can put it all on a thumb drive. Like if you got into OpenAI, you could put the core part of ChatGPT onto a thumb drive and take it out.
Right.
Like,
yeah. And presumably there are people who think that there are countries that have done that, but security would be a real challenge, I would think. But anyway, so the proprietary models of these private sector companies are closed weight. With open weights, you just tell everybody what they are, and that enables them to do various things with them. And in fact, maybe we could talk about what you did with Llama. I gather that at AI2, you both build open source models from scratch, but you've also amended open source models in a way that you could only do if it was open source, if you had the weights, right? So what kinds of capabilities or whatever did you add? This was Llama 3, and I'm not sure that the latest Llama was even open source or that Meta is going to...
It was released, but it just didn't have good performance. Like, Llama 4 exists, but the performance and kind of usability was low, so it just hasn't been adopted. So it's just kind of like...
So it was open.
It's like, I can put something out there, but if no one cares... Like, if it's not good, no one's going to care about it. And like, the first Llamas were all excellent, and then Llama 4 was just kind of like a little broken, so nobody actually uses it.
By the way, Mark Zuckerberg emailed you and offered you a ton of money?
I have not gotten a Zuckerberg email.
You know, neither have I. That's such a weird coincidence. But I'm waiting. I check my email every day. As most people probably know, he's been paying ungodly sums to take. He'd probably rather take the people from competitors than from you, because then it's a twofer from his point of view. So if you were like at OpenAI, I'm sure you'd have heard from him by now. What did you do with Llama 3? Like, what can you do with an open source model? How was your model, the model you created from it, different from it?
Okay, yeah, I'll start with this, and then at some point I'll give a longer spiel. But essentially, when you release these model weights out there, it fits with these words like pre-training and post-training that people have heard. I think that's the easiest abstraction to draw on, which is, as a researcher, I've mostly worked on this post-training or fine-tuning, or it's like when you're trying to kind of squeeze the final performance out of a model and you can take it into many different directions. And this is what my research area primarily has been on. And the stuff that happens before it is released is this large-scale internet pre-training, which is like it's the word like foundation model, and it's just kind of like this big underlying like massive knowledge that the model has accumulated before it goes into these final weights that we were talking about. So mostly of what I've worked on personally is like kind of after this internet scale pre-training, which is called post-training, which is where all this like reinforcement learning and stuff is going on now. So like what these projects that you're referring to at AI2 were doing was essentially we're taking Meta's weights that they released with Llama, and we're trying to create new like open data and just new research pipelines for doing this training that is evolving really fast in the industry. And our goal is like Meta released a version of this when the model came out, and it's like, can we do better than they did by reading the rest of the literature out there, taking improvements from new open new models and data sets that have come out, and just like, can we do what they did in a not fully open way and make it better, add new things in? So it's like, it's in many ways still very much academic research, as I would go to the conferences and stuff, but it's like, can we make open recipes that people can then study and modify? So we use the Llama model and we trained on this, and like we call these like post-training models like Tulu, which is just kind of a brand name that we have back to the early models that people were doing this were called like Alpaca and Vicuna. So there's all these animal names in it with Llama. So we had our addition to it. So we call this like open post-training recipes that we do research on.
Okay. So, in case people didn't get any of that, pre-training is what you probably is. It's like all they talked about in the beginning, like a couple of years ago, was like it scours the internet and does a until it can predict the next word. And that's what it learns to do. But there was always this thing called post-training in some form. And I gather post-training is more and more important, since you can only scour the whole internet kind of once. I mean, But what you did, so you saved all the money that you would have had to spend on pre-training. And then the post-training you did, which involves a certain amount of it, is what's called reinforcement learning of various kinds. So that was, broadly speaking, the same kind of post-training Meta had done, but you wanted to see if you could do it better? Or did you add wholly new techniques of post-training?
Some of both. I think part of it, the biggest motivation is we don't actually know exactly what Meta did. So we're trying to like see if we can do something that beats their performance while we actually knew it. And then in this specific project, which was in the fall of 2024, we had started adding some more of these reinforcement learning techniques in, which was like a wholly new thing for the like open research community. But actually, if you like ask people in industry, all this like OpenAI O1 and DeepSeek R1 with this chain of thought stuff was trained with these reinforcement learning techniques. And a lot of people knew about it in industry, but there was no one that could release a clear study of like, here's how you start to do it in like on top of Meta's Llama model. So a lot of it is like, we are first because no one can talk, but we also do the science of like, what should people try here?
And how did that go?
I think it's good. I have a whole... It's very useful for the community. So I know that in big picture, we talk about pre-training and post-training. Pre-training has always been way more costly to do. So there are a lot of researchers and small companies that are interested in doing this post-training or fine-tuning for their domain. So in a perspective of impact, I know a lot of companies that are like, we use your open recipe as a baseline or something that we can build on for our own products or take the data. So there are few entities that are actually doing this in the open because of how like AI is seen as extremely valuable. Like I should say that AI too is a nonprofit and like not the OpenAI style nonprofit. It's like, it's been a research institute for 10 years. In some ways that sounds similar to the OpenAI story, but like culturally it doesn't have the same, like OpenAI has this culture of needing to scale and this like foundational belief of worrying about Google. Where AI2 was always much more connected to the academic community and the University of Washington. And like that center of mass makes it much more academic than OpenAI ever was. So it's like, we just want to be a part of that. And then a lot of people build on it.
Yeah, I can see some differences between your vibe and Sam Altman's like already. And we've only been speaking for 20 minutes or so. I guess, here's a question. So again, the thing about OpenAI is researchers who really know what they're doing can do what you did. They can take a model and they've got a big head start compared to having to start with the pre-training and can fool around with it. Now, one question is, I assume you would say that if there were a more robust open source ecosystem in the US and for that matter globally, that would have an accelerating effect on AI progress. It would tend to make things move faster. Is that your view?
Directionally, yes. Like definitely it makes it so more people can do more relevant research. And like the single thing that I focus on a lot right now is having these model weights that are close, like stay close to the frontier. I'm not an absolutist that thinks like GPT-5 just came out. Like I'm not going to be like OpenAI should release that. Like I see safety risk in that. There's always like this time lag. And especially in the last, like if you look at the American models, the lag in performance between what OpenAI and Anthropic are doing versus the open models from the US is getting bigger. And what has happened is that the Chinese models have, in the same time where U.S. progress is slowing down, the Chinese performance and just number of models they're releasing has accelerated. So most of the research is now on these Chinese models. And that is like, if I'm going to review recent research papers in the areas I work on, most of them use Qwen, which is from Alibaba's cloud division. And it's what is enabling AI research. So I think it's hard to say exactly how much fast, like, more models will make it so that more people can address more specific research questions. So it'll make progress faster. I think I could prophesize, I could say like, oh, it'll make it so much X percent faster, but I don't know exactly how research ecosystems work.
But faster. So this is one factor when people decide whether they're kind of for full speed ahead on open source or are worried about open source. One question is, are they worried about rapid AI progress? People who are worried that rapid AI progress may leave society unable to adapt fast enough and all hell will break loose are probably going to be more skeptical of open source than people have who have a sunnier view of where rapid AI progress.
Yeah, my response to that is I would rather have the entire research community of both computer scientists and not be able to see into the models that are evolving than to just have it at two companies. Because I trust the full community trying to making decisions around rapidly evolving technologies more than I do the few great people that would be in these high pressure scenarios at OpenAI and Anthropic. I think just like distributing the kind of understanding is, in my opinion, safer from a kind of just making sure something weird doesn't happen. But
yeah, I mean, just to be clear, I was talking about people who worry, and I mean, I'm kind of one of these, but worry about whether social institutions outside of AI research will adapt fast enough or whether it will be destabilized. And I mean, unemployment effects, just everything, whether it be so socially or geopolitically destabilizing that we should worry about it. But anyway, I mean, that's one set of concerns. But anyway, back to what you're saying, the what kinds of things do you worry, like if you imagine a world where it was all proprietary models and a few big companies dominated, what kind of things do you worry would be in the models that we wouldn't know about or wouldn't be able to try to correct or what? Do you have specific things in mind?
I think it's less about this like model knowledge thing. I mean, it's obviously politically in vogue to try to like, people want to correct the models to have the right point of view. I'm mostly on the, just the, I see the biggest tech companies being so powerful now. And if I'm very optimistic about AI's capability. I think there's a lot to untap. And if it is to make all of NVIDIA, OpenAI, Google, Apple, 10 times bigger companies or 20 times bigger companies, like I just don't know what that does to our society in terms of how much power they have. And I just think that this is like, there's going to be a lot of upside. So making it more spread out is like, if I could nudge towards that direction, it seems like an easier thing to do or like a better thing to do. That's like value alignment.
Yeah. And I mean, if you imagine that it becomes like a winner take all model, you might not even have three or four companies dominating. You might just have one.
Yeah. The speech of it, the more concentrated the power, the more concentrated AI becomes, the more worries about speech can be there. I think XAI is the leading example where it seems like one sole person has the finger on the voice of the AI, which is like it does this weird Elon search thing if you ask about sensitive topics.
Yeah.
But right now, like people don't have to use Grok. If Grok was 100 times smarter and everybody would feel a need to use Grok, and then it would be a much bigger issue, which is like that is an example of the type of risk of concentration of power that I can give. It's like, we're still humans. We're still fallible. Like our companies will not be perfect.
Yeah, no, this is why I find open source such a challenging issue to have a clear opinion on, is because there clearly are risks from about centralization of power. And because with AI, it's almost, I mean, to talk about freedom of speech almost under-dramatizes it. I mean, you're talking about machines that are going to already have pretty impressive persuasive capabilities, like, and could in principle do persuasion on a scale like we've never seen. And if that's all in the hands of one person and it's like not a great person, it's obvious.
Can I give some context on things that something that's very undefined in open source AI is how people actually use these open models relative to open source software. So open source software is really like we get on our terminal on this call, install some pieces of open source software, look at the code or modify it really fast. Whereas these open language models, especially the powerful ones, are just gigantic files that take a lot of work to actually run. So like you need these GPUs normally for the powerful ones, or you need software in your computer, where it's just not really the same type, the same norms of like just like habits for people working with it don't exist like they do in software. So that is still TBD, which is like what are the default use cases for open source AI? There's these little things like healthcare or banking, but the just in terms of like the actual, when you're trying to use it, it is so different that there's going to be really different frictions and distribution and like how, like most people aren't going to download open language models. Like if you had a good, if you just had free software on the internet, people know how to get right. it. And it might bridge this gap. But we're in that like indetermined period where the debates on like what is the future of open source AI actually mean. They're really interesting, but I like to spend time on the topic because I don't know what it's gonna look like. And we just have to think about it because it's an important issue.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can imagine, and this only just occurred to me while you're talking. I mean, you're suggesting that, you know, most people, certainly right now, not many people are equipped to do what you did, which is take an open source model and really take advantage of what an open source model lets you do, which is change the weights and through subsequent training. But you can imagine a world where there's like a niche business of marketing tools that like let me customize an open AI, an open source model, right?
In a year, like if you take Claude Code in a year, I bet if you give it a credit card, it can figure out how to fine tune a model where like it figures out which cloud provider to go to. It figures out how to download a model from Hugging Face. It passes it along. And once that's abstracted away, it doesn't really matter how hard it is. If all you have to do is ask ChatGPT to do it for you and it does it. But like, I think that's reasonable to think about.
Now let's talk a little about one of the things people worry about with open source. So this is a quote from Jeffrey Hinton, who, in case anybody doesn't know who he is, he was one of the most important figures in the whole deep learning revolution. And he won not only what is sometimes called the Nobel Prize of Computer Science, the Turing Award, but the actual Nobel Prize as well for his work. He said in 2024, quote, "Open sourcing big models is like being able to buy nuclear weapons at Radio Shack. It's crazy to open source these big models because then bad actors can fine tune them for all sorts of bad things." Is that a concern of yours, but you think it's outweighed by other considerations, or do you think it's not even a very realistic concern in the first place?
I think it's an unrealistic concern because one of the things that happened with DeepSeek is that we saw that there was this famous $5 million cost of training models, which is that there are so many people in the world that can make that money, that can get the money to train these models. So it's like we cannot stop any somewhat wealthy nation from figuring out how to train AI. So if your policy is that nobody should release AI, there are a lot of people that are independent entities that can do things. So I'm of the side that we need to prepare for a world where there are powerful AI models that are in the open. Ideally, we want to have setups like the current US equilibrium from a safety perspective of these closed labs being 6 to 12 months ahead of the open models is a good like safety and security equilibrium. And so long as we keep something like that, where the models from international entities that we have no control over, like as long as we're just ahead, that's kind of the best we can do. And I don't think we can just stop, like we can't stop China from releasing these. I think there will be more countries than just, like there are more countries training AI models. There's some countries in the Middle East are investing in it. We hear about this with the compute deals and stuff. It's like we just need to be prepared for these things, for the internet to be everywhere. Otherwise, it's like we're kind of lying to ourselves.
Yeah. So we, up till now, we've been talking about what you might call, I guess, generic pros and cons of open source. In other words, if you just imagine like there was only one nation, within one nation, what would you worry about, and what would you think was like a virtue of open source? But as you've just, now you're bringing us into kind of geopolitical territory, and that's adds a dimension to the debate, right? Like, and I think that's what you've been emphasizing in advocating more, the commitment of more American resources to open AI. It's clearly not your only consideration. You just listed some others, but you've been talking somewhat in geopolitical terms. And by the way, do you have like a project, like an, is there a project you're trying to get off the ground Or am I confused?
So I 8 days prior to recording this, I launched what I called like the Atom Project, which is a catchy name for American Truly Open Models, which is mostly a website and branding that I could put up there to get interested parties, whether they're working at tech companies or VCs or researchers. It's just like, who cares about this? And then what I'm doing now is I'm filtering through the emails and having conversations with people that might actually be able to make this happen. So I think that the place I work at AI2 is, I think, poised to do some of this. But I think we just need, we want to have multiple of them to make sure it happens and have a kind of healthy ecosystem of multiple parties participating. And like AI2 just needs, would need more resources for it. I know like I'm not like the CEO or anything of AI2. I don't look at the balance sheet, but I know that the leadership is trying to do this. But I just think relative to, if you look at the hundreds of billions that these American tech companies are paying for capital expenditures for AI, doing this kind of truly open models can cost orders of like hundreds of millions of dollars. And these tech companies are going to be the people that benefit, because it's like the research ecosystem being in their kind of sphere of influence, it means that they get to pick up these research ideas sooner. It's designed to run on NVIDIA hardware or AMD rather than like Huawei chips coming up. So it's just like, it's relatively cheap. It's just not the focus of people that are trying to race at the cutting edge of AI. I see it as this kind of make sure that the researchers for the next decade have relevant models to work with. And it's not just like a total, all the relevant models are closed and we kind of suffocate research a bit. And that's what I'm seeing. It's like, you had talked about these post-training models on Llama earlier. The other thing that AI2 does is we do pre-training of like fully open source models. So the difference between this open source and open weight, awful terms. I feel like all this terminology stuff, really confusing. So the truly open source just means that we give you the data set so that you can do it yourself rather than just these final weights. So it goes back to open source.
What is this data set referred to?
So if we pre-train, if we did this training on like a selection of cleaned up websites, like this large scale web data, this is what Meta and OpenAI and all of them will never release. One, because it's a trade secret. Two, because they'll probably get sued up the wazoo. But like, as a nonprofit, like we can release this for people to do research on. Like we're not commercializing it. So that's what we do, and that's what we say the difference between like what we're doing and what Meta is doing is that researchers can look at our actual data and try to learn stuff about AI. And then this goes back to open source software where it's like free to modify and stuff. And if you don't release the data, it's hard to change the model in a future run because you just don't have what they made with the ingredients of the recipe.
So sometimes they don't even reveal, broadly speaking, what kinds of post training they did. Leave aside the data set. I mean, do they not even necessarily say, okay, we did some reinforcement learning with human feedback, focusing on this kind of stuff. And like, they don't even go to that much detail?
It varies. So for some of Meta's Llama models, they actually did a very good job of saying like, here's the methods we used. Here's some of the trade-offs we saw. Like, here's something that didn't work. So Meta has done some of this. They haven't done it really with Llama 4, but some of like Llama 1, Llama 2, Llama 3, like those had it. And that's helpful as like a guiding post. But then it was kind of left to the researchers to figure out the fine details or anything they omitted.
Okay. But anyway, you advocate complete transparency. So if something emerges from your Atom project, it will disclose all the training data as well as presumably the finished weights. Is that right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I really see it as an R&D play. It's because it's a finite thing. It's like these model weights are one thing. It's kind of like if you do it once, it's there for people to modify and to study for however long it's relevant. So it like kind of has this nice fixed cost idea of like, we know the end point. We know all these labs have trained good models. We know DeepSeek has gotten up to speed. We know AI2, like we're training good smaller models. It's like, all we have to do is like, you have to bridge this to the, it's like a really finite thing, which I think If nothing else, personally, for me, as somebody who's interested in the arc of AI, it's just like a nice goal. It's like, I want to do something that matters. And it's like, I can put a 1 to 3 year kind of gate on it of like, what would be the most ambitious thing that I can do to think that I have a positive impact in this time frame?
That's a question a lot of us ask ourselves in various contexts. So are you happy with the first week's response to the Atom project?
The thing that I'm a creator as well. It's like, it would have been nice if it went more viral. But the thing that I'm happy about is how across all the different types of people who participate in the AI ecosystem, prominent people signed on to support it. I mean, signing on to support is not a huge thing, but at a company, it's like prominent people normally need to ask if they can sign something because it signals something. But it's like the chief strategy officer at OpenAI was like, this is a good initiative, or prominent VCs or prominent researchers. There's just a large coalition of people who agree that it's the right direction to go in. And then it's hard to get, like, where do you get $100 million? It takes a long time for the government to spin up that type of money if it's going to come from the government or private sector. It's just now in that I'm now in the learning about how moving money around for ambitious projects happens in the nonprofit or academic sector. But it's mostly just being bold enough to be like, I'll talk to people about this if they're interested. Like, I'll do the legwork on it and see where it goes.
So these people are putting their names in public. There's like a letter they're signing publicly. They're not just emailing you and saying, maybe we should talk.
Yeah, so you can go to atomproject.ai, and there's a few hundred signatories, and we've pulled out like chief strategy officer OpenAI, president of Mozilla Foundation, very prominent VCs in the Valley. It's just like, there's a lot of people that if you follow the AI ecosystem, you see some really loud VCs as well. So there's like some people that are really loud about this, but don't really have, like, they can't really do anything. So like, how is a VC going to manifest an AI model? It's like what are they going to do? It's like kind of a few steps.
Well, yeah, because if you're a VC, you think about business models, and in some ways, I guess it's a challenging business model. I mean, that's why you're doing it in a nonprofit context for reasons I would say make sense, right? I mean, now the private companies make these, I mean, OpenAI, in fact, this is kind of lost in the GPT-5 release, but they released for the first time, right, a couple of open source models that same week. I wasn't sure whether this is to some extent a public relations move or whether it's actually part of a business model. Now, they're less powerful models than its proprietary model, right? What do you think the logic is behind that release?
You mentioned both of the things that I think are the real drivers. One is like public relations. I think that releasing these models, as long as you're not at the absolute frontier of performance, has been de-risked. They know what lawsuits Meta has gotten. They could handle them. They did a lot of research to make sure their model can't be fine-tuned to like say awful things and be unsafe. So they kind of addressed this anyone can take it and do a bad thing with it risk. And then even in private conversations of them talking to developers before the release, Sam Altman would be like, we have too much demand. If we give this model away, they run it on their own GPUs rather than burning the OpenAI GPUs. So that's like a real thing with open models, is like, it's like OpenAI has limited GPU capacity. So it's kind of a mixed bag. I would say most of it is on this kind of, I don't necessarily political, but it's just like it's influence is, there are people who are going to start with an open model. I think in the long tail of AI users, it's the people. It's easier to get approval for. You can tinker with it. And OpenAI wanted to be in that conversation, and the community has shown that there's just like the risk profile is lower now from there being more competition and from people getting their toes wet before them. So it just kind of like became a thing that's easier for them to do.
Yeah. And I guess they'll generate some revenue with it somehow. I mean, there are people who like a small, I guess there are people who like a relatively small open source model. I mean, other companies market those too. I think Microsoft and others, small, yeah. like, you know, there's less powerful open source models, right? That what you said reminded me, like when you said OpenAI knows how to keep it from do it, train one that won't do these bad things. If we could just revisit this issue that was raised, the Hinton issue. So, I mean, I assume what he's saying is that, you know, yeah, you can train it not to do things. Like, you can train it not to give people much information about how to build a biological weapon. And like, if it's a reasoning model, and they start nosing around in a certain area, like bio, that's relevant to bioweapons, maybe you can steer them to like a non-reasoning model or something. But I assume what Hinton is saying is that there are ways you could fine tune it to, in effect, break down those kinds of guardrails. Do you think that's a misconception?
It's not a misconception. I think it's just like, I think it's a trade-off or like where, his assumption, so it's like, I assume he's smart. He's consistent on this messaging. So it's not like, he's one of the people that is effectively at the start of this deep learning tree that has happened. So in some levels, mm-hmm. he definitely feels responsible for this super powerful technology. Mm-hmm. And I think the first pass is like, this technology is scary. I think, I don't think we're on this ASI path, but regardless, the pace of change and these new things that'll be coming, there will be new things that have maybe not ChatGPT sized impact, but like there's going to be really big new things that pop up in a month, in a year from these AI investments that are hard to plan for. So it's like we have entered this period of uncertainty, and releasing the models does add new types of uncertainty. So there has been, mm-hmm. there's people that do research on this bioweapon risk really issue. And like Rand did a study on it specifically with whatever the best open models were. And they saw that it actually wasn't relevant. But this is something that we need to keep testing. It's like the models get better. You need to retest mm-hmm. the risk. Because I think if I were to interpret him, it's almost like, he just knows we're not going to have the social structures to actually manage all the new types of risk that are coming, which I think is like the kind of generous interpretation. Because in some ways, I kind of agree. It's like it's going to be messy.
I wouldn't say our political system has been especially effective in generating far-seeing and finely crafted public policy.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah. I mostly have, through conversations, arrived at it's like, I just don't think whether or not these models exist in a strong performance region is something we control anymore. But it's like, so it's like my assumption is that his question is kind of, or like his statement is something that we just can't control. So it's almost hard to provide commentary on it. So I don't want to seem I'm answering like the next question in a way.
Yeah. Well, in a way, this brings us back to China, which that's where I wanted to go anyway, because the only way you could actually like ban open source is to do it with an international treaty or something. And you would also need to feel reassured that it was effective in other countries.
You can firewall yourself. So like the US could be like, we're removing ourselves from the internet. And like, if China has implemented that, I'm sure the US could implement that. But I think that's not a winning proposition in terms of like what values people have here.
And even that, by the way, if it's a bioweapon, that doesn't help. I mean, because biological viruses don't travel on the internet. So if the bioweapon is developed anywhere, you could be in trouble. So on China, now when you first said, well, I think, as I understood you, and tell me if I got it wrong, but that America's kind of overall AI research capacity is being somewhat hobbled by the lack of open source, because more people could be doing more research if there were this robust open source ecosystem. I had two replies. First I was going to say, but wait, can't the researchers use the Chinese open source models and learn as much from them? But you've said, I think you've said two things that hint to me at what your answer would be. One is you said the most useful open source in America will be on the American tech stack. So it'll be on NVIDIA chips and not Huawei chips. So, I mean, this is kind of ironic because what that suggests is that if we relax the chip controls, if we got rid of the chip controls, then we would be learning, it would be easier to benefit from Chinese open source models if they stayed on the NVIDIA tech stack. But anyway, that's not happening.
Yeah, it's like, I wouldn't say I'm a China expert, so I'm not going to like take this. I provide it as a grounding example, and I would be very unsurprised if you were to play out the game theory of it with like two steps down the line, if there's just some like, oh, that was a weird assumption, Nathan. I was like, I think it's just the most grounding example in terms of why do American tech companies benefit from the AI ecosystem being close to them? A lot of it is talent. Right. A lot of it is like the default research paper language right now is English. It has been for a long time, but that has changed in the past. And it's like, what if they're like, well, why are we writing these papers in English? Like, then that becomes a whole barrier to help. So it's a lot of these very soft things, right? It's just like people being used to using certain models that become standard. So like the closest thing to a standard in the research community right now is a Chinese model. And you, at the low level, there's tooling that gets developed that's a bit better for them. There's just know-how. So like me and my colleagues and I, it's like, we just know how to use this Chinese model now because it's the standard. So there's a lot of these soft boundaries that must accumulate over time. It's like I want to talk to more people that understand like how does science evolve and like what does that like how does that intersect? Like I want someone to battle test more of my ideas on this open source stuff. There, it just seems like this is. If you provide people with the tools made in America, like in the US, it's just an easier thing. A lot of it is motivated by how if you're building a startup in the US, a regular thing that you hear from customer, like you hear that companies can't use these Chinese models because you have to get IT approval. Your customers just are like, ooh, what if it's, even though it's not a functioning assumption of like, what if they take my data, even though it's just a set of numbers, it can't do that. There's just all these little trips where it's like a long list of people are wary of Chinese models and the US could benefit from having its own models. So I think some of it is like, I need to keep working on the communication of it, but I'm trying to paint a picture of why it's an important issue, but not one that's, like I'm not going to get the government like the DOD as excited about it. I'm not going to be like Chinese models have a known security flaw where if anyone in the US uses DeepSeek, then they have a backdoor into your computer. Like I could tell that story. It's not grounded in facts right now, but that's it's trying to thread these two needles.
But that's very much out there. I mean, there are scare stories about DeepSeek, right? That some of which are not valid. The other thing I guess you could say in response to the question about, well, can't we benefit from the Chinese open source models is, well, with in the Nathan world, the open source models we develop, you know, what you're advocating are just fully transparent. And although DeepSeek, they were transparent as these companies go, I think, compared to Meta. In fact, I was surprised, just based on listening to podcasts, how much they disclosed in the research paper. I mean, given, you know, when if you kind of accept the framing of this kind of hardening Cold War between China and the U.S., and you accept the idea, which I think is perhaps too simple often, but you kind of assume that, well, the Chinese government is controlling everything and these companies have no freedom, then you wouldn't expect them to really be very forthcoming about how they created that model. But they were pretty forthcoming, right?
Okay. So I don't know. I don't have a good grasp. I don't know your China knowledge. And my China knowledge is limited. But it's like my understanding of the Chinese government is that it's much more distributed than the U.S., even though that the communists, the leadership has a strong dictate and can filter that through the distributed network and make very strong pushes. But when I see a decentralized system, if there's something new like AI, the decentralized nodes on it, they're not going to have a directive. So they're going to be like, do whatever. But then in the next couple of years, we could see the policy change a lot in terms of how they message it. And I don't have a prediction there. But that's the thing. It's like if this AI plays out over 2 years and 5 years or 10 years, I do think we'll see trends where DeepSeek is one end. And then we'll see a clear definition of what it looks like the policy is in a couple years, but not this year.
Yeah. My understanding, I think maybe similar to yours, which is that the Chinese government wasn't necessarily paying much attention to DeepSeek before this happened. And in fact, it's not even, not all experts think that DeepSeek had to get the government's permission. But in any event, the Chinese government, they're familiar with DeepSeek now. They're paying more attention, and they're no doubt trying to exert more influence on its direction.
A hearsay on the ground is normally DeepSeek has released one thing a month, at least through like March or April of this year, and their releases have slowed down. We don't have enough data to know if that's a conclusive thing of them releasing less. But in the last few months, we've heard less from DeepSeek than we have in the 18 months before.
Okay. Well, listen, we're going to continue this conversation, but as regular listeners and viewers know, what we generally do is have a pretty long conversation in public, as we've had, and then we go into overtime, which is accessible to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which you can become by clicking the link in the show notes or going to the Non-Zero newsletter and clicking on this episode, which will be posted there. Anyway, Nathan's been kind enough to agree to stick around for some overtime talk. We'll talk more about China and get back to that, the whole DeepSeek story itself, which was such a fascinating thing on the global media radar. And we'll talk about other stuff. But first, Nathan, I want to give you a chance to say anything you haven't said. Again, the name of your newsletter is Interconnects. And if there are any billionaires who want to fund your Atom project, where do they go for that? Probably your newsletter, right?
Yeah, there's atomproject.ai, but if you go to Interconnects or you search Nathan Lambert, my email is like on my website. I'm an academic in that sense. It's not too hard to get in touch with me. I want to make AI easier to understand. There's a lot of hypey takes and fear mongering, and I try to ride a middle ground between it's nothing and it's existential risk. So it's like it's what's actually happening. So that's what I try to do.
Okay. So thanks everybody who's followed us this far. I hope you will follow us into overtime. That is where we're going to go now.